Whiskey, Must Report, Elvis Madness and Horror, but first...
Michael.
What?
No.
Oh, yes. That's the point. Endless Bad News and Horror. Okay, so we'll save that for all the people complaining about my Greg from Trax version that I used. Okay, here we go.
We didn't call for peace in Vietnam. We called for victory for the Viet Cong. We said, what about our brothers and sisters that were fighting against the same imperial empire in South Africa? We said we formed a coalition with the PAC. And we said, what about in Zimbabwe? We formed a coalition with ZANU. And what about in Mozambique? We formed a coalition with Frelimo. Now, I say all that to say that one of the things that the Occupy movement has inspired me is that it has reached beyond the question of one group versus another. We don't have any conflict. We know who the common enemy is. And that enemy you have identified in language that everyone around the world now identifies with, and that's the 1%.
Yeah.
I'm saying one thing. And the rest of us are the 99%. So the question is, what are we going to do and where do we go from here? And I want to remind you of something that made you who you are and us who we are as I joined in and gave my voice to what you already started in Oakland. Glad to walk the clothes down the port of Oakland. Tell me they lost $4 to $8 million that day. I was like, oh, you had $8 million? That's it, $8 million right now. We won't close nothing down if we start having some profit sharing and some redistribution of wealth around here. But yes, let's shut it down every day that we're not getting a dime out of that. Five schools closing only need $2 million to reopen and they make $8 million a day. Give me a break. So what has the Occupy movement done? It's done what that is.
We'll be right back.
organize. Please make an announcement on this microphone.
Everybody, we're re-meeting at Oscar Grant Plaza tonight at 10 p.m. Meet us back at Oscar Grant Plaza at 10 p.m.
Occupy Oakland specifically. So we'll be proud. Let's say Let's join together. Let's keep this going. And let's remember, the power belongs to the people. All power to the people.
And if following up on the line of the next action, they are using white phosphorus on the children of Yemen. If you go to Greg Allen Getty on Facebook, you can see a picture where I reacted with anger, a little red smiley face, and wrote, "Over my dead body, at the tracks, next Monday, 9 a.m., 5300 Port Chicago Highway, blocking documented white phosphorus arms depot." May have been Brian Wilson when he had his legs handed me that document that showed that the weapons station north of Concord, now incorporated into the city of Concord, but of course the port is way a couple little miles north of there, but anyway, it's all accessible by road that you can stand in the way of. So see me there at 9 a.m. next Monday if you don't want to be guilty of dropping that white phosphorus on that child in that photo. And on that subject, World Crisis Radio.
Comandante Noriega.
Oh, yeah.
The head of.
So I was going to mention all this because he's going to go into Noriega, and Noriega is archived here on Guns, Drugs Archive, Guns, Drugs, CIA, HTML, in the PBS.org website. Noriega's Contra support earned him powerful friends in Washington, including CIA Director William Casey, subject of Getty versus Casey. Noriega was on his payroll at a reported $200,000 a year. That was a very special relationship. Oh, that was Jose Blandón. Frontline, what kind of special relationship, Jose Blandón? Well, Noriega talked with Casey, and they had, at least that I know, more than three meetings, and he always received the support of Casey. What kind of support from Casey? Jose Blandón. All kinds of support. Political support, so when somebody tried to investigate anything, Casey stopped it. Look, this is a very important person in this war. Of course, there was the letter between Casey and French Smith, that's right. And it said, oh, by the way, we're not going to report, or you don't have to report drug crimes. And then that was what shook out of the Gary Webb investigation, where he got shot twice and the media participated by calling it suicide, twice in the head. And they don't say that. Of course, he could have had an automatic pistol with his finger kind of like clutching, spasming or something, but no, it wasn't that. The point of getting back to the lawyer, yeah, I'll just shut up.
Welcome to Redacted Tonight VIP. I'm Lee Camp. Today I talked to someone in the middle of a media firestorm. He's suing the Democratic National Committee and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, part of a class action lawsuit saying they were biased in the primary election. And even though this lawsuit is not over, it has already brought forward mind-blowing revelations about the DNC. For example, they believe they have no obligation to have a fair primary or to not rig it for one candidate or the other, even though they are taking donations from people who believe it's a fair primary. And last year believed that Bernie Sanders had a chance to win.
Well, the... cut to the chase, the people paying the Democratic Party on the pretext that they will count their vote and all are being met by the the party bosses, the party of Robert E. Lee, saying we don't need no stinking voters. So the fracked three-fifths black box chumps. Okay, we were founded the year after the UK abolished slavery, and the slave raping people whose heads belonged on the post of their plantations that you see on your money were saying, it goes back before that, but Most of the people we declare the enemy who cannot vote, you know, the 99% that were here. Most of the people are women, you can't vote. Most people don't own property, you can't vote. And if you are property, of course, you can't vote. So this tiny minority is called the majority. And, well, anyway, Democratic Party was the party of Robert E. Lee, was the slave party. And, of course, slaves can't vote, so you can call this democracy. You can call it majority rule, but it's the opposite.
Honestly, I cannot stress how important this trial is, and the mainstream media cannot get enough. They're all over it. What's that? Oh, I'm sorry. Apparently, they haven't. They basically not mentioned it at all. No, can't. They won't.
Well, of course, it's the Russians. The Russians are coming. The Russians are coming now. Actually, the Russians are on the side that we are at war against. Remember the Contra War? Well, that drove me out of the mountains after. Well, yeah, because I didn't really move to Yahi Bay until, Ishi Bay, because the Yahis were extinct by then. But Ishi lived here in Yahilan. Here's. Okay, so we, the murderers of the Yahi, pretend that, you can't have a minority president in Syria, but, of course, their puppet Saddam was a minority because they're majority Shia in Iraq. So they kind of got contrary standards when you're waging war against these people. And then, of course, we have to wage war against the death squads that we sent against the, quote, minority government, unquote, of Assad to save the minorities that they're busily exterminating to no one's surprise. Ah!
They used that as a cause belly for attack, even without any United Nations resolution or any word from the OPCW that agrees with them. And as a matter of fact, you know, this kind of sequence was so predictable that in 2014, in an interview I did with Vice, when they asked me what I predicted would happen now that Syria has given up its chemical weapons, I said that I predict the US is going to claim that Syria has not completely disposed of its chemical weapons and use that as an excuse to airstrike army positions, possibly after another small chemical weapons attack is set up. This is going to be a similar scenario to the lead-up of the Iraq War in 2002. I believe the US will start airstriking the Syrian military as well as Al-Qaeda-linked rebels, effectively attacking both sides of the war. Now, I'm not a psychic, this is just how we work. And I think it should be obvious to everybody by now. And, you know, the other war narratives that have been pushed forward are what Jay touched on, minority governments, and at the same time they have a contradictory, simultaneous narrative that they have to protect minorities. So they have to get rid of minority governments, but then they have to protect minorities. And it's a bit schizophrenic. And one of the things, you know, you hear that Saddam is a Sunni, majority of Iraq is Shiite, Assad is Alawite, majority of Syria is Sunni, and no, you know, the fact that these governments are secular in their basis doesn't feature. And the fact that, you know, Obama was black and black people are a minority in the United States didn't occur to him when he said that Syria had a minority government. So, now, you know, once they kind of destabilize the country or even get rid of its government, then they move on to the second narrative, which is that they have to protect the minorities. So in Iraq's case, you know, Saddam gassed the Kurds, or more recently, ISIS is killing Christians and Yazidis, so we have to go in to protect them. And in Syria, at the moment, they're protecting the Kurds. But even in 2014, we had like some hints that they were pushing forward the new narrative, which is that they have to protect the Christians and even the otherwise. And it became a perplexing thing, because all along they were pushing for Al-Qaeda to take power in Syria and for them to turn around and pretend that they're protecting Christians and other minorities is ridiculous. And I guess perhaps that was a bit of a premature narrative push, because the plan was always for Syria to be divided and for Assad to actually run away to the coast where the majority of Alawites are. And in doing so, basically disband the army and create a situation where the U.S. can come in to save the Alawites. And the only way to create a situation where you have to save the Alawites is to create the threat that's attacking them, which is to create terrorism. So I'd like to go to backwards now, but maybe 5,000 years ago, thereabouts, I don't know, 1750 BC, and just to see how Iraq and Syria connected. Back then, in the olden days, Syria and Iraq were separate entities, but then under the Assyrian Empire, they were connected as one state. It's a very famous empire, it brought a lot of things to our society. And then under the Roman Empire, they were again considered Syria and Assyria, you know, separate states, but they always had some sort of connection between them. And the reason why this is significant is these people from 5,000 years ago, like the people, their history and ethnicity, they still exist today. And the considerations that existed way back then, they still exist today. I mean, the Armenians still exist, the Syrians certainly still exist, and all of the battles that were happening 5,000 years ago are actually affecting what's happening now. Here comes Sykes-Picot. When the Ottoman Empire fell, of course, sorry, I misspelled Sykes-Picot, excuse me, but when the Ottoman Empire fell, basically the French and the British divided the Middle East amongst each other. And the narrative is kind of pushed forward subtly in the media that Iraq and Syria are artificial nations because the borders were drawn up by Sykes-Picot. Well, in reality, the borders that were drawn up by Sykes-Picot were wrong only because they didn't encompass enough territory of the natural borders of Iraq and Syria. So the purpose that Sykes-Picot had in drawing up these borders is to try to, as much as possible, create landlocked nations. Lebanon and Kuwait were basically created as a way to restrict Syria and Iraq access to the Mediterranean and Gulf Seas. They were also designed to divide population centers from resource-rich areas. Kuwait holds a lot of petrol, and Lebanon holds a lot of water. So this is a way to kind of make sure that people stay in poverty. And of course, finally, they want to divide people along sectarian lines and keep them fighting with each other for centuries or decades to come. And Lebanon and Syria were exactly created under these religious sectarian lines. You know, initially, in fact, Sykes-Picot wanted to create even more divisions inside Syria. But all sects of Syrian society, all religions, were against it. So if you look at the first map, that is, in fact, how the Sykes-Picot was meant to be drawn up. There was supposed to be an Alawite state over here, a Druze state. Damascus and Aleppo was supposed to be divided. But the only thing that they achieved was the region of Lebanon, because of the Maronite population there. They achieved that division, and they annexed this Turkish part right here. And if you can just keep this in mind and compare it to the new Sykes-Picot, the new drawing up of the Middle East and the divisions that they want to create, you can see that it's very similar to the states that, well, they divided Lebanon, they divided Hatay. They want to go back and get their Alawite state, and they want their Druze state as well. And with Iraq, you know, they want to divide Sunnis and Shias and Kurds. And the only thing really different about this map to the previous map, which I'm not going to risk going backwards, is that they have this Kurdish section here. So this Kurdish section wouldn't have existed back then in Sykes-Picot's time because the Kurdish population in Syria wasn't nearly as significant. The only reason it grew in Syria is because of the Armenian and Assyrian genocide and the Kurdish population's involvement and help of the Turkish government in doing that. And then subsequently, the wars that were fought against Turkey, multiple wars that were fought by the Kurdish uprising against Turkey to try to get their own independent state. And as a result of that, there were several influxes of refugees coming to Syrian territory, which continued up until the 50s. So this is something I'm going to talk about more deeply in my next talk. But the interesting thing is, this map here, the beginning map, is from the center, so the Council of Foreign Relations. Much of these maps are drawn up by think tanks that the Washington government basically replicates every advice that they're given by these think tanks. And as you can see, they wanted to create not only like, the Kurdistan and Alawite states, but something called a Sunnistan. And if you compare that to the borders of where ISIS is, you can see that ISIS is exactly the Sunnistan that they wanted to create. In fact, ISIS has been essential to all of these plans because the Syrian war and the sectarianism that happened in the Syrian war would not have been possible without the Iraq war. It wouldn't have been possible without the introduction of violence and weapons and militias and hatred between Shiites and Sunnis in Iran and Iraq, if not for the Iraq War. And the US at the time of the Iraq War, I remember the theme of the media was saying was that we need to prevent a civil war, and the US is like there to prevent a civil war. But as a matter of fact, they were acting to always undermine the unity of Iraq by introducing, for example, federalism into the constitution, for removing a secular government and introducing a religiously leaning Shiite Dawa party, by disenfranchising one sect and empowering another, and getting an army built from one sect to fight, cities that were resisting in another. And also, they would even go down to, Saudi influence also funding these groups. And finally, they would even stoop to creating false flag attacks. These two men are SAS soldiers. They were caught by the Iraqi police, the pro-US government Iraqi police, caught them dressed up as Arabs, shooting at them. And this was a story that was quite hidden in the media because on that very same day, British tanks destroyed the entire police station to get these two men on. So you can see that they were already trying to get some sectarian tensions happening. So I'm going to rush. I hope I have time. So Syria and Iraq, now the foreign policy papers are coming out with, do Syria and Iraq exist? Do they, should we even consider they exist? And should we base our US policy on the idea that these sovereign nations that are seen as sovereign under the United Nations exist? Basically, they're saying that they no longer exist. And of course, the narrative is that Sykes people got it wrong, and that's why there are wars. And by separating these nations under sects, this will be the end of wars. But in reality, the wars are happening because the imperialists want to implement Sykes-Picot as it was originally meant to be implemented, dividing people further. And you might ask, why would that be? Well, of course, it's easier to control landlocked countries, to make sure they're resource poor, to make sure they continuously fight alongside each other, and they want to have a way to get their oil pipelines through without having to ask a government that controls the land to get their pipelines through. Now, at the moment, the US is actually building illegal military bases in the north of Syria. And they've also got plans to invade from the south so they can connect their pipeline through. And, speaking of these think tanks that are redrawing these maps and creating these maps of the Middle East, I believe Gondoliza Rice called it the birth pangs of a new Middle East. What she meant was, all the children that were dying in Iraq, that suffering was just the birth pangs of the new Middle East. All of that, it actually is predated by the Israeli Odid Yunon plan, which was written in 1982, which said explicitly that these nations should be divided under sectarian and ethnocentric lines so that they would be in perpetual war with each other and Israel could have the causes belli of expansion. And in fact, at the end of the day, a lot of it is about imperialism, yes, but there is this other agenda driven under the scenes of a greater Israel, of a creation of expansion of Israel, driving populations out. This the land that is written in the Zionist handbook is that everything from the Nile to the Euphrates. And of course, the Kurdish borders that are being drawn up by these think tanks are everything beyond the Euphrates. And that's why you have Turkey coming into Syria with Operation Euphrates Shield. Because these borders and this chaos that's been happening has been planned a long time ago. So the thing is, though, that these, you know, redrawing maps, you might not be someone who's a nationalist, you might not care about borders, but in order to redraw these maps, ethnic cleansing has to take place. Because in order to create areas that are designated for different sectors of society, you have to get rid of the areas of the ethnicities that are already in certain areas. So, for example, to create the Kurdish state right now, they're in Iraq and Syria, the Assyrian minority is getting pushed out of their land by the Kurdish, the US-supported Kurds, Yazidis. And ISIS has been like crucial to this, because whilst the Kurdish militias are well-armed, the other ethnicities have no arms and no training, and in fact, when they do arm themselves, the Kurdish militias threaten them with attack if they do not disarm. And once they disarm, there has been recently, in fact, in Iraq, where the Peshmerga basically left the Assyrians and the Yazidis to the devices of ISIS. So ISIS has been basically the enzyme that's built to create these states. And there's going to be more on that in my next presentation, but I'd like to finish off with a little bit of a counter statement, because these things are not set in stone. For example, really what they expected was for the Al-Qaeda to be too strong to overwhelm the Syrian military and to begin to do what they promised, which is to ethnically cleanse Christians and Alawites. And what they hoped was for Assad to run to the coast, and then therefore they would come in with a savior complex and create an Alawite state. That hasn't succeeded, because in fact, the people of Aleppo who were running away from the Al-Qaeda rebels, the majority of them are Sunni, and where did they run? They ran to the coast. So this is actually the opposite of the ethnic division that they want to create. In fact, they achieved more of a unity inside the coast. The only thing that they have been moderately successful with is the creation of this Kurdish state. And now Kurds are 1.5 million people in Syria out of a population of 22 million. So you can imagine, you know, one out of 22 trying to take over these swaths of land which are filled with oil and water. So the thing, the counter narrative of that, however, is that Syria is planning to connect Palmyra, Deir ez-Zor, and Qamishli, and thereby cutting off what would have been a sliced in half Syria. And that's probably the reason why the US is conducting airstrikes on Deir ez-Zor, the Syrian army location, because they, even though it's been under siege by ISIS for so many years, they really want it to fall. So this is what's happening now. I will talk more about the ethnic cleansing element of it, and more specifically about which areas are being ethnically cleansed in my next talk, so I hope you will stay.
That was Syrian Girl, published on this, May 11th. So, pretty recently, University of Sydney, and she's talking about the background that we hear the Russia, Trump, Russia, bad. So, the Contra War had Russia on the other side. That's counter-revolutionaries and the racist Takfiri army unleashed in the Arab Sting, the Scarab Sting of the Arab Spring. That was the Contra War. Hillary, of course, the Secretary of State, and part of the Poppy Bush's Arkansas-Mina Cokestand duo running guns in trading for coke. And the Medellin cartel was down there where Zaparo Oil had a couple offices. One is Medellin, and Felix Rodriguez, who waved Che's watch during those investigations because he was present at the murder, even though they said he was the only outsider, obviously covering for Klaus Barbie, who's sad when he was captured by the French, and it was in 1983. I'm just a good American of German extraction who was only doing his job. But that's the side that Hillary and Bill are on, who sent the National Guard to Honduras, the Democrat. And the Republican, Duke Majan in California, did not send because he knew, no, we're not going to use Californians to back up death squads building roads up to the border in Honduras to overthrow the Sandinistas, who doubled the literacy, cut the infant mortality rate in half, got UN health awards, and therefore brought down this war. They had to stop by voting for the Contra Alemán. No se olvides, gringo, porque yo no.
Won't touch.
Oh, when Barbara Lee tells the Dixiecrat, tells the party of Robert E. Lee, tells the party of slavery, and there are some obstacles to your Russian investigations. He's talking about me because the Russians sailed into San Francisco and we put the boots to our six Southern brothers over that issue, slavery. No se lo olvidas, the son of a five-year-old bunny killer is not going to forget hatred of slavery when he tells... Don't bring me back if I'm dead. Not to this world that has slavery, this house of bondage. So anyway, this house of slavery, of bondage, those the shores of Tripoli where you made peace with my enemy, Washington, Lincoln, and you whose heads belong on the plantation posts, you know, you Dixiecrats, you're losing your statue, that human waste eater, producer, Robert E. Lee, but... this party says, we don't need no stinking voters, we don't need no stinking hacked, fracked, three-fifths black box voters hacking with Seth Rich, okay?
This story with a 10-foot pole, because it reveals the corruption of our voting system. They put an extension on the end of the 10-foot pole, get like an 11th foot in there, you know? Well, guess that's why you come here, right? For stories like this. Without further ado, here's my interview with Jared Beck, the lawyer representing Bernie Sanders supporters in a class action lawsuit against the DNC. So you brought this lawsuit on behalf of Bernie Sanders supporters claiming the DNC and Debbie Wasserman Schultz did not hold a fair and impartial primary between Sanders and Clinton. Walk us through what evidence you have that's the case and what exactly you're claiming in court.
Well, the evidence consists largely of documents that have already leaked into the public domain via WikiLeaks, Guccifer 2.0, and other evidence of that nature. And what they overwhelmingly show is that the DNC, from the very beginning of the primaries, had and did make every concerted effort to ensure that Hillary Clinton would be the nominee. And so the DNC was crafting media narratives and working with their partners in the media to harm Bernie Sanders at the expense of or in favor of Hillary Clinton. We also have evidence showing that the DNC was taking sides in disputes between the candidates, such as the famous Las Vegas chair throwing episode. We have Donna Brazile giving debate questions to Hillary Clinton in advance. And of course, we have the resignation of not just Debbie Wasserman Schultz, but other top DNC officials in the wake of the release of these WikiLeaks emails. So
right.
We think that the evidence is very, very convincing that the DNC was not impartial or even-handed in its conduct of the Democratic primary process.
Right. And those emails are pretty cut and dry. They're pretty obvious. And now I think a lot of people would assume that the DNC lawyers in this case would be arguing the DNC was totally impartial, they were fair, and we had a legit primary between Sanders and Clinton. It was all on the up and up. But in fact, they aren't claiming it was a fair primary. Talk about why they claim this lawsuit should be thrown out.
Right. And so at the most recent hearing on the DNC's second motion to dismiss the case before we even get to trial, the DNC's counsel pushed in front of the court a series of arguments in the nature of that the DNC has no legal obligation to conduct the primaries in an even-handed or impartial manner, notwithstanding what its own charter says, notwithstanding what Debbie Wasserman Schultz and others were assuring the public through the mainstream media throughout the course of the primaries. But this is the legal position that the DNC's own counsel has taken in court, that, and this is really to paraphrase, they could go back to the old days and smoke cigars and pick the candidates that way, and there would be no legal accountability. That was essentially their argument in court.
Right. It's truly mind-blowing that they argue we could go back to picking candidates in a dark room and we have no legal obligation to do otherwise. And it's like, if that's the case, if you want to argue that and that's the case, why are any of us voting? What are any of us doing here? What's the point? It's so mind-blowing, and I think that's one of the reasons that in my opinion, and I think the opinion of a lot of people, this should be a major news story. The Democratic National Party is saying they are not fair and impartial. They are saying they do not abide by a fair democratic process. And so I think people think this should be a major news story. So I assume that all the mainstream media is talking about this, and you have been accosted for endless interviews on most of the media channels. Is that correct?
Quite the contrary, Lee. There's been a mainstream media blackout on this case, including on the issues that came up at the hearing as you described them. And let me just say two things about that. I think the DNC has both a legal problem and a political problem. The legal problem with its arguments is that they are just not true or sound as a matter of law, because we are bringing fraud claims on behalf of those who paid money to the Bernie Sanders campaign, believing that they were participating in a fair and impartial political process. And that's just turned out not to be the case, as WikiLeaks and Guccifer 2.0 documents show us beyond dispute, in my opinion. So those are fraud claims, and there is no exception to so-called political speech, which is what the DNC is trying to say in court. It's just there's nothing, no case law precedent for it. But there's also, besides the legal problem with their argument, there's also the political problem. They are basically trying, at the same time they're going around on this so-called unity tour with Bernie Sanders across the country, trying to get people to join the party, they are going into court and saying that they have no obligation as a matter of law to run the primaries in a democratic manner. And so I think that's a big, big, big problem that goes contrary to the message of unity that they are pushing at this very moment in public.
Absolutely. I mean, it shows kind of a backroom disgust for the voters they're courting. And, you know, some people, I guess, would argue that such a lawsuit does harm to the Democratic Party. But in fact, this is the only way to save the Democratic Party, because any party is not going to attract voters if they blatantly rig the primaries or argue they're allowed to. So tell me, are you doing harm to the Democratic Party, Jared?
I'll answer your question this way, Lee. I've represented victims of fraud for a long time in my legal practice with my wife. And one thing about victims of fraud is that there can be no reconciliation between the victim and the defendant, the perpetrator of frauds, until there has been justice. Okay, and I think this is what our case is trying to seek on behalf of all those who were defrauded in connection with the 2016 Democratic primaries. And honestly, if the Democratic Party is seeking unity in a bona fide manner, then it also needs, I believe, as part of that mission, to come to terms with the fact that the people that we represent demand and need justice for what happened.
Absolutely. So, I, if I have this right, right now we're waiting to hear whether their motion to dismiss was accepted and it would get thrown out. If that doesn't happen, what are the next steps in the lawsuit?
Assuming that we get past this pending motion to dismiss, the next step will be what's called discovery, in which case we get to probe into what other documentary evidence exists besides what's already come out into the public domain. And we also get to take depositions, which means we get to put witnesses under oath, and they must give sworn testimony. So at that stage, we would hope to take depositions of all the key players as well.
So that could be a big, discovery could be a big step, and let's hope we can continue to get to the bottom of this. Have you or your people spoken to Bernie Sanders at all? Has he weighed in on this?
Not to my knowledge.
So going forward, what is the best case scenario that you can see coming out of this?
Well, I think, in my view, there are two prongs to this case. One is obtaining compensation for everybody in the class that was harmed by the DNC's conduct. And number two is we want a trial, and we want a jury to decide the facts, because we think that that's really an essential part of what needs to happen here. I'll just quote the judge who stated at the end of the hearing, democracy requires truth so that the voters can make intelligent decisions. And I think, personally, I think the trial is not only one of the most democratic institutions we have in this country, but it's also one of the best means for getting at the truth, which I also believe is vital to democracy.
Absolutely, and I think you're doing a great service to our democracy or what's left of it, because you know, we've gotten so far afield from anything that actually seems to be a representative democracy that anytime we can reveal the truth of the process and therefore get back to a genuine and impartial process, I think is a great step. What can you speak to what shocked you the most about this? Like, did you know this lawsuit would be this controversial? I mean, I guess you must have going in.
The most shocking thing about the lawsuit, just I think, has been the blatancy of the DNC's conduct. We had in March of 2016, we had a young man by the name of Nico House who came into our law office with evidence that he had accumulated on the ground as a Bernie Sanders organizer in North Carolina, which strongly suggested that the Bernie Sanders campaign had been infiltrated. You know, we were investigating that, but it wasn't until the Guccifer 2.0 leaks dropped in June 2016 that we were in a position to actually be able to file a case in federal court, because at that point we had tangible evidence from the DNC's own documents that this was a concerted strategy that had been pursued by the DNC leadership from the outset of the primaries. So just having that evidence just come into the public domain was really quite a surprise.
Yeah, it was kind of the smoking gun for what we all had all been talking about, or a lot of us had, how heavily impartial those the primaries are. Well, I wish you luck, and I hope that obviously it's not thrown out in this motion to dismiss.
Well, thanks for those kind words, Lee, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be on your show. I'm a big fan of it.
We have to go to a quick break, but New York City, Atlanta, Chicago, Minneapolis, and Washington, D.C., I have live comedy shows. Welcome back to Redacted Tonight VIP. Yesterday was a big day. Chelsea Manning stepped out of prison for the first time in 7 years. As Edward Snowden said, she left behind the safety of silence to speak a truth that saved lives. And when Obama made the decision to commute this hero's sentence, every single congressperson was elated.
So your reaction to the commutation?
Rage, frustration, and sorrow.
Okay. Back to Iran-Contra.
The Reagan White House were going wild, and Noriega might have been a part of that. But nevertheless, he had to take the fall. Then, Al-Ghadi. And this is interesting because there was one Teflon Don who didn't maintain his Teflon status.
And Giuliani can make a point. Now, he also takes credit for taking down the Sicilian mafia when all the Sicilian middlemen are winding up dead. Of course, we got to switch over to the Pakistani middlemen. But obviously, he doesn't have any of that stuff. Now, excuse me while I go find John Trudeau. I have not found the audio, but let's just go with this part two. This is Radical with a T dot O-R-G, Many Worlds, John Trudeau, Human Being, HTML, part two. It's from his Women's Building talk. When you vote for the lesser of two evils, I condemn you, applause. Bleep, you're doing. What the fuck are you doing? I presume. Actually, if you vote for either one of the evils, I condemn you. Laughter. Bleep, what the fuck are you doing? I'm guessing what bleep means. By our acceptance of the lesser of two evils, so to speak, we're using our intelligence to create what goes on. See, I don't vote. I never have. I vote in Amsterdam, whatever that means. Laughter. Picked a winner, too. We didn't have to have recounts. We knew, but I don't vote because, I mean, my reasons for not voting are very valid. See, when they created the voting system here, the democracy here, when they created it, I was the majority. Hey, look at me over here. Oh, I see you. So you're the enemy. You can't play. Laughter. So the little old majority rule thing came out of the smallest number of people, all right, the smallest number of people on the entire hemisphere, continent. All right, they decided it was going to be a majority rule. There's something about it, all right, that I don't trust. Laughter. I inherently don't trust it. And applause. And I don't understand why you do, okay? So now that we're the smallest numerical minority on our own land base, they say, come vote. Now, so in that scenario, who's stupid, me or them? Well, anyway, and I'm bringing this up about democracy for this reason. And it's about coherency and using our intelligence. I think that every generation of human beings has the responsibility to decide how they and their immediate descendants will live with the earth. I think it's our responsibility, right? I think it's our responsibility to do that. And I think when I look at democracy as a native person, see, to me, it's just another chain. You know, freedom is a lie, you know, democracy. I mean, you know, think about it. Every democracy had a land-owning class. Every democracy had some form of slavery. Every democracy had some form of sexism. And I'm saying this not because I'm trying to overthrow anybody's anything, because, you know, it's just, you know, it's not about that. It's about, oh yeah, it's about the next generation. We live in an evolutionary reality, and maybe it needs to evolve, and maybe in the best interest of our seventh generation, it may be the enemy, but I don't mean just by just it by itself. I'm talking about all the industrial faces of control systems, whether it's democracy or fascism or socialism or any one of these industrial faces and mechanisms to control the mass of people, because every one of these systems have a small class, an ethnic rich, an industrial ruling class, and a planetary ethnic rich. And every one of these governments, no matter what they call themselves, they serve that master. Now, I am happy to be reading it because that means I have to pay more attention than if I was just listening. But we live in an evolutionary reality, and maybe it needs to evolve, and maybe in the best interest of our seventh generation, it may be the enemy. So like, when I read that sentence, I did not know what it meant. So just don't trust my inflection, because I don't know what I'm talking about. Quoting my dad when I said I was proud, he thought, never mind. So don't misunderstand me. This is about a perceptional reality. Oh, there's a dash there. It means he's dot, dot, dot. Here, I come from a tribe, and whatever has been going on in my evolutionary journey, I still remember that. I'm confused about a lot of things, but I remember that. I remember when I was born, there's never been a question about the memory, but they're trying to take that memory away. But the memory of the tribe, see, 100 years ago, 120 years ago, Geronimo said, the Americans, they're messed up, you know, we call them the Americans. See, so I feel a kinship to those ancestors, and when they, what they saw and what they tried to stand up against, I feel more of a kinship to them than I do to be a lapdog to this system and promote its lie. Applause. All right, because I think it's irresponsible. Now, this is right after the Jim Crow coup. You may not remember roadblocks in the hood on election day. You may not remember the 100,000 stripped by Choice Point from the Florida voter rolls by the grandson of Hitler's banker, so that another grandson of Hitler's banker can sit in the Oval Office where, yeah, that make me want to puke. So let me hit the yellow square and I'll spare everybody everything else I may ever say today.